West Legal Aid Center and West Legal Works with Dwayne Morris would like to welcome all of our participants to Private Equity Challenges and Opportunities in Middle Market Exits. Again, thank you for joining us, and I will now turn things over to our moderator, Robert Copeland, partner with Dwayne Morris.
Hi, this is Bob Copeland, and I'm going to moderate the program today. I'd like to welcome all of you who are participating by telephone. Thanks very much for joining us. Very briefly, I'd like to introduce our speakers in the order that they're going to present today. First off is Wade Hansen. Wade is a managing director of Cabrillo Advisors. He's had a long history as an investment banker and has founded three successful investment banking firms, the latest of which is Cabrillo. They're located here in San Diego and have particular expertise and experience in the representation of middle market companies in the sale process. Second speaker is Dennis Dunn. Dennis is a managing director of Carlisle Enterprises. He's been with Carlisle for something like 20 years and has been actively involved in Carlisle's M&A activities all that time. Carlisle is a private equity firm and has been active as a buyer in the upper middle market arena for many years and has now refocused on the mid to lower middle markets for acquisitions. I'm a partner in the San Diego office of Dwayne Morris. My practice has been almost entirely involved in M&A transactions on both sides of the table for about the past 30 years. Stephen De Bonaventura, our last speaker, is a partner in our Philadelphia office of Dwayne Morris. Stephen heads up the firm's tax practice. He practices in the area of federal and corporate taxation with a concentration in mergers and acquisitions. There's a lot more about all of us in the bios that are part of your materials if you're interested in looking at that. At the top of the program, I think instructions were given for posting questions. We certainly welcome them. If there's an opportune time during the presentation, we'll take a question or two, but likely we'll just get to as many as we can at the end of the program. Let me turn just real quickly to what our topic is, just to kind of remind everybody. It's been observed that the lower middle market, the companies in the lower middle market, are largely underserved by both investment banking as well as the ability to find and attract either equity capital or buyers. It's our observation, those of us that are on this panel, that a sale of one of these lower middle market companies often presents really unique and beneficial tax and economic opportunities to both the seller and the buyer alike. So our program is going to attempt to cover a number of these opportunities and introduce you to a banker, a private equity investor, and specialists who structure and do deals in the area. So with that, I'm going to just ask Wade Hansen to go ahead and lead us off.
Great. Thanks, Bob. One bit of context for the comments that I'll be making over the next 10 or 15 minutes is the traditional training I had was actually not investment banking, but strategy consulting with McKinsey & Company, focused on leading their high-tech M&A practice in Silicon Valley during the late 90s. And in doing that, worked with much larger companies on matters of strategic growth and identifying companies that would be exciting for them to expand their businesses into. So as I moved from large company consulting into actual investing on behalf of Dell Ventures and then ultimately working with middle market companies, I've brought with me more of a strategic mindset about thinking in terms of options and what would be best outcomes for a company. And it's been really satisfying, actually, as I've taken that down to middle market companies where owners are truly benefiting from that type of thinking in terms of what they should do and what they might not want to do. With that as the sort of platform, we asked the initial question, is waiting for the phone to ring a viable exit strategy? And intuitively you would say, no, of course not. But it's amazing with companies that are under $50 million, let's say, how many of these types of processes get launched with a blind phone call. One day they're sitting at their desk and somebody calls and says, you know, we're competitor X and, you know, we're interested in making an offer for your company. And pretty soon they're, you know, deep into some kind of a discussion around whether this is the right time for them to do that. Is that the right price, et cetera? And so we find that that's an initial reach out point probably for both legal professionals and folks like ourselves to get involved with a business. And it's really helpful when one or both of those leads to some, you know, strategic thinking around what the option set actually is and how best to maximize the value of the business, which I think, you know, a team of seasoned advisors like we probably have on this call can provide. One thing that typically is lost, though, unless you're in a large money center city, such as Chicago, New York, Boston, maybe San Francisco, L.A., you do tend to find a limited view on what private equity firms can bring to bear in the middle market. And that's really where, you know, the focus of this discussion was launched. We have been working with a number of private equity firms, both from our days as investors and now as advocates for companies in the middle market, to find the best opportunity for them based on what the needs are. Because not everybody wants to sell their business in whole. Some would like just liquidity, but to continue growing. And some have tremendous growth opportunities, but they don't have the financial resources to pursue those. And as Dennis will, you know, describe in his presentation, private equity firms can really be great partners and or exit options for business owners in those situations. And as the market for large-scale deals has gotten more and more competitive, and firms that were successful doing traditional middle market have migrated to larger funds and therefore larger company acquisitions, we're finding a bit of a vacuum in the middle market, which firms like Dennis's now are starting to fill, that do particularly well partnering with businesses where operating skills and financial resources can really bring the business to a new level. So that's our setup, which was slide four. Slide five, we talk about building your business to create value before a sale. In a perfect world, you know, companies in the middle market are thinking about what their options are long before that phone call occurs. And in doing so, they're thinking through a myriad of legal, accounting, and just business preparation issues that would put them in the best position both for themselves and in their market's context to be successful in a sale process. We have a number of different chevrons there going on the left, but some of the ones that I think are really critical is to understand where your business is in the sector, you know, both who your competitors are and who ultimately would look at you as a strategic asset in their game plan, because it might be that, you know, growing in a particular region or really buffing out a particular product line can maximize value over and above a generic strategy of growth. Additionally, you know, looking at structural and tax considerations, these are definitely things that if addressed, you know, years before the actual event occurs, lots of money can be saved and businesses can, again, be in a better position to be acquired because there won't be issues that will require indemnity holdbacks or money set aside for risks that otherwise could be avoided. And then finally, with a business owner, if we have those on the call, you've got management succession issues. And it's definitely the case that a lot of times an owner operator doesn't necessarily want to see the business go away. They don't necessarily want to see it be acquired and dismantled by a large corporate buyer. And so thinking ahead about how to position both a management team that could continue on and also maybe look at finding a partner such as a private equity firm earlier in their thinking about exits can really benefit the business tremendously. Slide six is an abbreviated version of what I would say exit options are that do include private equity. Certainly, when you get to the sell now bucket, there might be three or four other options, but we're focusing right now on a decision that you would sell. But clearly, status quo is always an option. And if you're a business owner and you're doing well, you know, it may be the case that you just continue to run the business, you continue to pay down debt potentially on acquisitions or growth events that you've, you know, been focused on, and look for organic growth, such as hiring additional salespersons, or, you know, investing in R&D to continue to grow the business. And frankly, that's a perfectly successful outcome for a lot of folks. may require some financing, but certainly is a lower risk option in terms of ongoing operations. But somebody may be looking to be more aggressive, could consider building through acquisitions. You know, here again, you most likely will need to look at raising some capital, and this is an entry point to where a private equity firm can partner with you, even if you haven't made the decision to sell now. Private equity sponsors are often brought in, you know, as low as 51%, typically in a control position, but really partnering with that owner to go after either a market consolidation opportunity or just picking up strategic products to round out a portfolio. And then finally, as we talk to business owners, the sell now option, which is potentially why they phoned us, is that they've got an offer on the table and they wonder if it's a fair offer. And this really gets into, you know, where an investment banker plays a role, helping that business owner think through its set of options. Traditionally, strategic buyers were the focus, and that made a lot of sense because in the middle market, private equity firms weren't so interested in businesses as low as 3 to 5 in EBITDA. And as large successful funds get more and more successful, you're seeing they're really looking to take down public companies to make deals make sense for them. But we have been finding more and more there's an opportunity to work with firms like Carlyle to present an alternative to a strategic buyer. And as it says on the right, you know, which one creates most value and which one fits with personal goals are intertwined questions because as we found, there's not always a best and highest price making it the right answer. It's not always the case, and we'd talk a little bit more about that here in just a moment. On slide 7, if selling today is the answer, again, we're trying to narrow the topic down. Does it make sense to hire an advisor? Certainly incented to say yes, but I think it's the case even if I were the business owner, and in fact, I do have a business where I use agents on my behalf, both to distance myself from the other party and give myself some leverage, but also to get some clear thinking and some analytic horsepower around the transaction that I otherwise might not be able to dedicate given my day-to-day responsibilities. Why hire an advisor? There's a number of points there that I think are probably clear to those of us in professional services. Identify more diverse set of buyers. The relationships that we would have are, you know, institutional and things that we focus on daily. If you're a business owner, you know, that's not your universe of relationships. You're very focused on customers, your competitors, your employees. But knowing, you know, the 10 private equity firms in Southern California that could potentially be interested in you is not a top priority. So clearly leveraging that set of relationships, giving bandwidth to prepare materials and identify issues in advance, very valuable. And then lastly, you know, having people on your team that know how to deal with the twists and turns, you know, of a transaction are invaluable. And I'd say the team is not just an investment banker. Typically, you're looking at an auditor, tax person from the accounting side, and a legal representative, an attorney, who can help you navigate the, you know, various types of opportunities and offers that might be given to craft a best possible scenario for the potential seller of the business. You know, and then I'll skip through the what Cabrillo brings uniquely, but I stated it up front. It's not just a pure investment banking approach. We really do try and come at it both from a strategic context and knowing, you know, where the opportunities lie in an industry. Because frankly, if an industry is at a peak, it may be a perfect time to sell to someone, whether it's private equity or a strategic, so that even if you're growing your business, multiple contraction on your EBITDA could eat away any potential new value that you'd create by growing the business over the next so many years. So there is sometimes a right time to sell, and we're helpful in identifying that through scenario analysis. On slide 8, this is just to give people a bit of a sense of what, you know, a timeline would look like for a sale process. I think while this is an indicative approach, it's clearly the case that depending on specific drivers of a transaction or a business's operation. This timeline can be accelerated or it can slow down. What I've typically found is on the initial preparation and marketing side, getting interested parties to the table within, you know, 2 months to 3 months is usually very doable. Where things start to potentially bog down is based on company bandwidth to meet the requirements of potential buyers on their due diligence needs that are specific, and then also just operational things that may be uncovered that need additional work to sort out, again, succession planning and so on. So I think getting to a letter of intent, pretty doable within a 3 month time frame, maybe four, depending on how broad of an audience you have. Multiple offers, obviously, will take more time to process. But the execution side can take longer than most people would like to hear. It's not selling a house. You've got a lot of moving parts, and people really want to make sure as they enter into this decision that they've got all their bases covered. What's really interesting, and I have had the opportunity to work with Dennis in the past on a transaction, is in the preparation for, say, day zero and going forward, I think private equity firm buyers tend to do a much more thorough job of lining up the strategy and the go-forward plan for the business up front, whereas I've seen strategic buyers tend to do more of a cost analysis and staff reduction planning. So it's a very different set of activities happening from letter of intent through to closing. But for those people that are looking to, you know, stay active in the business as a minority owner or even in transitioning it to their management team, private equity folks will invest very heavily on that planning front to make sure the strategy is baked, it's clear, it's actionable on day zero, and that when the business relaunches as a partnership or as an owned by the private equity firm, everyone knows what they're doing and how to do that. So move to slide 9. You know, what are unique positives and challenges with a private equity buyer, specifically in the middle market? As I've experienced it, and these, again, I've never sold a business of my own in this space, but what I'm hearing consistently are a few things. Confidentiality, you know, jumps right to the top. You're working with someone who's not a direct competitor, so sharing critical market, company, customer data, pricing, et cetera, doesn't leave you exposed if the deal doesn't go through. And, you know, the reality of it is there's a lot of things during the course of a sale process that can derail the sale. So having that confidentiality is a very valuable thing as you work with a private equity buyer, different than a strategic. Speed to closing, again, we've got people that are doing this for a living, so they're very capable of working through issues as they come up. Due diligence is very orderly, typically, and their ability to close and be decisive on a transaction is far and away more capable, particularly in smaller companies like we're talking about, than a large corporate buyer would. Treatment of key employees, I think we've kind of mentioned this, but as an owner thinks about their exit and they're thinking about the next two or three people that maybe don't have a wealth event on that particular sale, setting them up for an opportunity to build wealth themselves as they take that business into the next level, very valuable and very much a decision point often when offers are in the same ballpark. How key employees are treated often will tilt it toward a financial buyer as opposed to a strategic. And then lastly, and this sometimes seems a little bit like marketing from a private equity firm saying, hey, we're giving you an opportunity to co-invest, and a seller might say, wow, that sounds like seller financing to me. Really, I've seen people get incredibly wealthy on that second bite at the apple where the 25% or 20% that they've rolled in a deal actually becomes worth more than the 75% they sold up front. So it's kind of a nice way to get liquidity, but also if you do believe your business has growth potential, to not sacrifice that in its entirety to create some stability in your own life portfolio. Of course, there are some challenges. You know, valuation is the one that typically pops up when a seller says, but, you know, do they really pay top dollar? You know, I think a strategic buyer is more likely to overpay meaning pay more than the business is really worth because it potentially fits a very key strategic need. And they may be doing a make versus buy analysis that says it's worth more than sort of its financial underlying metrics would otherwise say. But over the last few years, financial buyers have found very creative ways to be competitive through use of leverage and also focusing on businesses that have growth potential. So my experience is that they're typically right in the ballpark and oftentimes with some of their ability to bring an co-investor in, actually make the deal sweeter than a traditional strategic. Deal size, again, and Dennis will speak to this, but typically financial buyers are looking for a minimum 5 to 10 million of EBITDA. So sometimes smaller companies aren't interesting. If you have a client or you are a business owner that is sub 5 million EBITDA, it doesn't mean that there would not be interest, but people will look more heavily around what the market opportunity is, what the growth trajectory of that business is. And again, you're looking at a situation where professionals have X amount of time to work on a deal, and they really need to make sure that they invest time in deals that have the right amount of upside. And then lastly, management transition, just again restating that sometimes financial buyer require the owner to stay, and that may or may not be in the cards. My last slide, slide 10, is really a transition to Dennis and Carlisle. As they were the ultimate buyer of an asset that Cabrillo sold earlier this year, quickly it was a manufacturer of life science imaging systems. We created a book for that sale, took it out to probably 30 strategic buyers, all of the majors, and actually only one or two private equity firms. It was very much serendipity that I found out that Carlisle was even investing in deals of that size. But as everything kind of came down to the wire, we had strategic offers, which was sort of a flat cash-out price, likely blow up the entire management team and roll these products into a larger entity. And the Carlisle opportunity, which was, let's use this as a platform, potentially add some things to it, keep management intact, and look for an exit somewhere down the road. The owner really liked that option and, frankly, took a slightly lower price for the benefit of seeing, his business stay intact and his management team have a chance to really have a wealth event of their own. So with that, I'd like to pass it over to Dennis Dunn at Carlisle Enterprises.
Thanks, Wade, and good morning, afternoon to everyone on the line. In my section, we'll canvas several topics. First, to explain why private equity investors may have an interest in middle market and, in particular, lower middle market businesses. Next, describe what we look for in candidates that make them attractive in our eyes. Thirdly, in the view of private equity, the benefits of electing to go with a private equity partner versus other avenues as a means to exit. And finally, we'll give you an example of one structure, but one of the preferred structures that we like for partnering with a business owner to achieve partial exit and then subsequent full exit from the business. If we move to page 13, let's first review why private equity has interest in lower middle market businesses. There are a number of compelling reasons, again, especially in the lower end of the market, where we have begun to focus a high percentage of our resources. First, it is an underserved market. Many of the businesses are too small to fall into the radar of strategic buyers, and there are not a very large number of private equity firms engaged in this size range, frankly, because the funds are so large that they have to deploy larger checks in larger transactions to get the funds invested. So there's a clear need, from our view, for capital and other resources to move into the market on the lower end. And because of this, it is also a less efficient market. There are fewer buyers in general and fewer formally organized, sophisticated investment banks advising these firms, as Wade has discussed. and also when there are multitudes of suitors in the higher end of the middle market, it is usually impossible for a firm like Carlyle to even get an opportunity to demonstrate the firm's differences, and so therefore we cannot differentiate ourselves from other buyers, and frankly we feel that some business owners miss out on the opportunity to discover and ultimately partner with someone that has a unique set of capabilities to bring to bear on the business. The valuations are lower in general, again, because there are fewer buyers. Another reason is that there is inherently more risk with smaller businesses, less critical mass to the business, usually thinner management as a whole, and more customer concentration are all factors that we see that increase the risk profile of these businesses, and therefore the valuations offered for these businesses are on balance lower. Despite that, if you were able to fashion a transaction with an existing owner, as we'll show later, and move it into the next size category, there is a definite possibility for multiple expansion upon exit. And again, as we'll show, owners and management can share in that multiple expansion, wherein the business grows from a lower middle market category to a more typical sized business in the mid-range or upper end of the middle market. And the multiples have been shown historically to move up when you make that transition. We have found that with the growing sophistication of business owners and founders in the mid-market size category, many of them come to the conclusion that they've simply reached a level that is at the natural limit of their abilities to grow on their own, and they are therefore very receptive to bringing in a partner that can assist them in a number of ways. From our standpoint, we feel like we have in-house resources to add value to these kinds of businesses. If you visit our site, Carlyle is comprised of about 5 managing directors and approximately 20 limited partners. All but a couple of the principals involved in that group of approximately 30 people are operating executives that have run, in many cases, several different businesses, Fortune 500 industrial businesses in the main, and in many cases, multiple industries as well. So we feel like we can leverage those in-house resources in these transactions and lend support to these businesses, which is in keeping with the owner's recognition that he needs an infusion of not only capital but of management resources and other resources to help him grow the business to the next level. And finally, final reason why we have an interest in the market is that there are very few formally organized groups. To successfully compete for acquisitions here. And it's important to be to have the experience in the private equity field and have experience across a number of transactions, because the small transactions can be just as complex as the larger deals, and especially when you throw in the founder chemistry element, dealing with all the attendant emotional aspects of a founder making a transition such as this. On page 14, we outline the most attractive characteristics of our targeted candidates in this area. These are sort of baseline features for companies in which we develop an interest. The first point there on page 14, companies that we aggressively pursue should have one or a combination of the points noted there, the first being that they're entering a phase of growth where the founder, as alluded to earlier, is incapable of or frankly is not willing to risk a significant portion of his net worth in providing the funds and the time to a business to help it get to its next level. Business can require strategic guidance or need management additions. And thirdly, companies, we find companies that are attractive that are looking to utilize their business as a platform to grow via add-on acquisition. Ideally, we find a business with all three of those elements, but it should have at least one. In terms of ownership, again, as mentioned earlier, we like to find an owner-founder that is looking for a complementary partner to pursue growth strategies either internally and or externally. We must have a majority ownership available for purchase. We do that principally to have control from Carlyle's standpoint over the exit timing because ultimately we are obligated to exit and liquidate these investments for benefit of our investors and ourselves. With that said, we do welcome significant reinvestment and actually prefer that in most cases by the current ownership, particularly if they are active in the business. In terms of the competitive profile of businesses we seek, we like them to be well-positioned. They don't necessarily have to be one or two in their markets, but in that event, we like them to have some sort of a leadership position in a particular niche of its industry. We also like the markets that they serve to be sufficiently large. Buying a $20 million company in a $50 million market, while they have a significant market share, in a small market, there aren't a lot of reasons why you can make an argument that the business is going to grow its market share position significantly, and the ultimate market that they're serving isn't large enough to support that growth profile. In terms of management, we definitely prefer to partner with management teams that are in place. I mentioned that normally management is thin in some of the smaller businesses. We have the capability, based upon our composition, to supplement those resources in interim or even permanent roles, or we can draw upon our network. As you might imagine, the each of the senior operating executives that make up our group have significant Rolodexes that we draw upon regularly for people or to open doors. Management equity participation we'll get to a little bit later in detail, but we like to have management involved in the ownership. Normally they are not owners prior to the transaction, but we give them two avenues. First, through direct investment, where they actually invest alongside Carlyle on the same basis and at the same cost. And secondly, and more importantly, we have management equity pools as fixtures in our transactions, where at least the senior management team participates in a pool of, say, 8 to 10% of the fully diluted ownership in the business, structured over a 4 or 5 year period, where they vest in that stock. So they have the ability to create a significant payday if the growth targets are hit and the company performs as we'd like it to. On page 15, we attempt to highlight some of the key differences between a private equity firm and a strategic acquirer on the one hand, which can often benefit a business owner. Wade alluded to some of these. Just to recap, from the equity side, we are in the business of investing equity capital and making a return on it, and we have it not only for the initial transaction or recapitalization, but also to make add-on acquisitions and to fund growth initiatives that may or may not be the case with a strategic acquirer. We also have experience with significant debt financing sources, which can provide the business with more flexibility than would otherwise be the case, certainly if they were on their own, and even in the case of other strategic parents, if you will. If a complete sale to a strategic acquirer is not attractive for any number of reasons, one alternative that we'll go through is a bridge transaction for the owner, which ultimately can satisfy and accomplish a complete exit from the business. We'll show how this type of transaction can enhance the owner's and management economics as well. Most financial buyers will want to maintain the founder's value add, so it is not the case that if you're looking at private equity, that a clean break from the business is possible on the first transaction. So this bridge type of arrangement allows him to liquefy some of his hard work and also create an opportunity for another payday down the road. Also, it's important in the bridge transaction to note that it helps accomplish a business continuation and assist in a program to help the founder groom a successor. Another benefit is that the business owner, assuming that most of his net worth and time are tied up in the business, they diversify some of that net worth, pulling some of his eggs out of his basket, and overall lowering his risk and allowing him to diversify those funds into other investment arenas. And with an operationally capable partner like Carlyle, the owner receives a significant infusion of operating resources and talent, as well as the financial and strategic expertise to grow the business to the next level. Again, this assumes the owner is not interested in a full exit or selling out to a competitor. We find that many owners are very interested in maintaining the legacy of the business and growing it, staying committed to sustaining the business, protecting the employees, and so forth. So all of those are available to an owner were they to choose to move down the road with a private equity group like Carlyle. On page 16, we prepared an example of a recapitalization where the owner reinvests in the business alongside Carlyle. Again, this is just one avenue. Would not address the situation where you have a passive owner who has not been involved in the business, who wishes to move out of the business entirely, and he has a management team in place that has been taking the business through its various phases of growth for quite a long time. We certainly would accommodate that kind of a transaction too. But this example that begins on page 16 is more of a pure recapitalization and a reinvest by the current ownership under the assumption that the owner wants to stay active. It does offer the potential, as we've mentioned, for two paydays, and also introduces, perhaps for the first and only time, attractive economics for the management team working alongside the owner. In terms of the assumptions, we have a target company here with revenues in the $20 million range and a $2.5 million EBITDA, which is a nice margin for businesses in this size, and a purchase multiple assumed of 5x, which is in the kind of in the middle of the range of what we're seeing for lower middle market businesses at this time for the reasons we mentioned. The current owner in this example, we have assumed we'll reinvest 30% in the equity. Management invests a small portion, but probably not trivial in terms of the magnitude of dollars. We find that smaller company management teams don't typically have a lot of liquidity, so we have no problem in a guy investing $5,000 or $10,000. If it's meaningful to him, then it's meaningful to us. We have an incentive equity package baked into this analysis as well, that the results of which will become clear on the next page. And for simplicity, we're assuming the company is debt-free. So in terms of structuring this transaction, again, with the reinvestment, we have over 40% of the capitalization provided via equity, Carlyle providing majority of that, but the founder investing 30% of that equity, or about $1.7 million, and the management again with about $250,000 for a total of almost $6 million of equity in this example. The remainder of the capitalization to complete the transaction is provided with debt. We have assumed, again, for simplicity here, that we borrow on a senior debt basis about $5 million, and a seller note of $2.5 million issued by the company. This is a this helps to underscore the feature in the market currently that for small businesses that the debt capability is significantly less, even in private equity sponsored transactions, for some of the reasons I mentioned earlier. Lenders are generally about half as aggressive with debt in these acquisition transactions on the lower side versus the typical mid-market size deals. So we have about not quite 60% of the capitalization here provided in debt. We could use mezzanine debt in these transactions for in lieu of the seller note, but again, have used a seller note here just for simplicity. Anybody has any questions on the debt markets, they can feel free to get in touch with me and I can provide further color. In terms of the uses here, the owner proceeds, including the seller note, are about $11 million. His reinvestment, again, is $1.7 million, and there are transaction costs which are always rolled into the transaction. What we're seeing here with his example is that the owner realizes all of the value of the business as currently valued except for his reinvestment, or to put it another way, he realizes 85% of the enterprise value of the business but still retains 30% ownership in the business. It's largely made possible by the use of debt. Our general philosophy is to be rather conservative with the debt portion of the capitalization because we like to have the company's flexible with sufficient dry powder to be able to borrow on those lines if we need to support growth, and also to keep the company flexible in the event that there's an unanticipated downturn in the business. If we move to a review of our assumptions regarding the exit transaction on page 17, you can begin to see some of the economics that we spoke to early. We first of all have assumed here in this example that we've been able to grow the business nicely, but not at an unbelievable pace. In this instance, we've assumed a 10% compound annual growth rate, so the sales of the business grow from 20 to 32 million, and the EBITDA grows to 4.3, which is not quite a doubling. And incidentally, the EBITDA margin here, there is no assumption on growth there. So these are somewhat conservative from that standpoint. Over the course of a five-year period, you should be able to retire all of the original debt if the business performs at this level, and we assume a five-year hold period in this example. I've got a question here that I may want to address at the end. I'll come back to that. In terms of the exit return summary, in this example, we have assumed here that there is a slight multiple expansion, again, for the reasons we mentioned. This business has grown, in this example, from an EBITDA in the twos to over four, and as you approach $4 or $5 million of EBITDA here, you're beginning to poke into the traditional mid-market range category, wherein there are more buyers because you've got a larger business to sell. And so purposes here, we've assumed an exit multiple of 6 versus the purchase multiple of 5. That results in a net proceeds from this transaction of a little over $23 million, and that represents about a 4x return on the total equity invested, and also equates to an aggregate IRR over that period of about 32%. This percentage IRR is actually higher than the targeted IRR of many large funds these days. But as a group, we are continuing to seek investment structures wherein we can realize greater than a 30% IRR on the transactions. And the lower middle market is one area where we think we're going to be able to satisfy that. Under those assumptions, the payouts in this exit event would be as shown there, with the founder realizing $6.6 million of the proceeds and management actually taking home about $2.5 million. As I mentioned, for many management teams, this can be a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity, and a sum of that nature spread across 3, 4, or 5 individuals can be significant for the key executives, particularly of a small business. And you see there the total owner proceeds of over $17 million, almost $17.5 million. The owner receives an additional $5 million by going through this process over and above what he would have realized had he sold the business outright and walked away from it in the original transaction with us. So this analysis shows how both sides can benefit when an owner, founder chooses to partner with an equity sponsor like Carlyle. What we hope we've attempted to do is show why private equity is an attractive avenue to explore for mid-market business owners. On page 18, we summarize what we've been through here in this section. There are a large population of candidates that are underserved in this area. While options may be somewhat limited, I hope we've shown that a private equity partner can be very attractive to an owner and offer economic incentives to him and the management team that they otherwise not be aware of. The recapitalization transaction, again, can serve to give the owner a second payday, as well as serve as a conduit for management to participate in the growth of the business when they otherwise might not be. And again, particularly attractive if the owner desires to stay on or is simply interested in preserving the legacy of the business. We believe the right equity sponsor can add substantial value to the business relative to strategic planning and accelerating the growth of the business above and beyond where it might be without such a partner, particularly if the equity sponsor is differentiated in terms of its resources that it can bring to bear as a partner to a business owner. Again, we can leverage our industry network, which is vast, and in our case, Carlyle's regional focus of our small business initiative supports our frequent involvement in the companies to help direct the business to the next level. In summary, all these factors, we think, paint a very attractive option for business owners find themselves in an evolutionary inflection point. And I believe now I will address the question here. There's a question on the multiplier that we are seeing in the market in the lower end. A 5x multiplier is in the middle of the range. I'll answer that. Attempt to answer that quickly by saying that the in the lower end of the middle market, when we began the process, we felt like the multipliers were could be a factor of 2 lower than the traditional mid-market range, which typically runs from 6 to 8. So 4 to 6 times is the broad, very broad range for businesses in the lower middle market that we are seeing, with the upper end of that range being warranted, if you will, with a very high growth business, proprietary engineered product type businesses, perhaps with patent protection, strong management team, again with a very successful, stable historical growth rate having been demonstrated. I believe that's the one question that was presented, and with that, unless there are other questions, I will. I believe that Bob will now address some of the legal aspects and related issues for business owners contemplating a sale.
Great, Dennis. Thanks a million. My slides start at page 20, and I'm going to maybe reorder the shuffling of the deck a little bit just to kind of keep us on track here on a time basis. Once the decision has been made to sell, what should a seller consider? Well, if we're focusing on the sellers that we've been talking about, which is the middle to lower middle market companies, there's really two points here, and those are: use experienced advisors and get prepared. These transactions are typically a once-in-a-lifetime kind of an event for the typical seller, and the buyers who are going to be involved in these transactions are going to be pretty familiar, going to be well-advised, going to be pretty sophisticated. So there's a huge knowledge gap that really needs to be closed, and that's done by availing oneself of a good investment banking firm, and I think counsel that's familiar with handling purchases and sales of companies. Now, for service providers like me and I assume a number of others that are on the phone, I think that it's hard to market sometimes to smaller companies our legal services because they get sticker shock when you tell them what the hourly rate may be. And I think that that there are just really kind of three points that are worth making in marketing your services. One, remember the buyer is going to have experienced counsel, and you need them too. Number two, even though the cost may be greater than the cost of the lawyers that you're currently using, the cost of a deal well done is going to be far, far lower than the costs that are going to ultimately be realized in a deal poorly done downstream. And they're just, I mean, all of us who've had any kind of runtime in this area know that. And of course, a third area for just marketing is to develop some relationships with the intermediaries that your companies tend to see before they tend to see the lawyer. On getting prepared, Wade has told us a little bit about that. I'm not going to go into it anymore. The company obviously has got to stand up well in a buyer's due diligence. The seller needs to assemble his internal team, particularly if management's going to be continuing over. They are part of the bench strength for the seller in terms of dealing with the buyer. And I think that it's important to try to get a seller up to speed on the sale process. And there are really two excellent resources for that. I've cited them in the slide 21. The classic, Anatomy of a Merger by Jim Freund. It's hard to get a hold of now, but it's still the classic. And then the M&A Process, it's a new publication by the American Bar Association, just came out, another good resource. So I would commend either one of those to some bedtime reading for a seller who's contemplating or getting involved in the sale process. Let me move on to talk a little bit about letters of intent, and I'm going to kind of jump around here. There's a lot of good resource material on letters of intent, but I think that maybe some sort of hot buttons or important points are worth kind of noting in this area. Obviously, before the letter of intent comes down the line, the parties need to have exchanged a confidentiality agreement. So whoever's advising seller of a company when an investment banker starts looking it over, and when some due diligence material is exchanged, that ought to be done under the umbrella of a decent confidentiality agreement, which binds the recipient of the company's confidentiality agreement not to disclose or use it to the detriment of the company, no matter what happens in the deal. as far as moving on to the letter of intent, I mean, I used to, when I first started out, I kind of had a knee-jerk reaction to, I didn't like long letters of intent. I thought that it kind of tied my guy down, either whichever one I was representing, buyer or seller, and that a term sheet or just a bullet point list of terms was the ideal way to go. I've really changed my mind on that, and the reason is number one, a buyer is going to definitely insist on an exclusivity period. They're not going to want to be the stalking horse. They're not going to want the seller out shopping the deal while definitive documents are going to be prepared. And I think that while sellers will often try to push back and shorten that period to try to maybe put theoretical pressure on the buyer to get with it, I think that it's simply short-sighted. I think that an exclusivity period of no less than 60 days and probably 120 days is more like it. It simply ought to be conceded. I think it's in, if you've got a buyer who's ready to begin negotiation of a definitive agreement, they aren't easy to find sometimes, and you think they're qualified and you've already decided to sell, then it's a sort of the bird in the hand, and so it's probably at least in a seller's interest, to kind of expedite or enhance that process rather than to try to impose impediments to it. In terms of how detailed should the letter of intent be? Well, again, I mean, from this is Copeland, the convert, so, you know, they're always a lot more probably adamant about stuff than people that weren't converts, but I think that it ought to be really detailed. I think that it's important for the seller to really have an understanding and a clear statement, as long as we're going to go through this letter of intent process, of things like if there's going to be an earnout, let's spell out how that earnout is going to work and when it's going to get paid and how it's going to get calculated. I mean, it doesn't have to be the 10 pages of the definitive agreement, but it definitely ought to be a good enough outline to guide the draftsman so that everyone, when they get to the definitive agreement draft stage and are looking at it, it coincides pretty well with what the parties set down in the letter of intent. If there's going to be a working capital adjustment or something like that, I think that that's another, that's another kind of an adjustment that's worth more than just a, you know, kind of a cursory mention, and it definitely ought to be mentioned. I'm clear over to page 26 now. I think that one of the places where there tends to be just a whole lot of angst and agony is, of course, over the indemnity, escrow, reps and warranty, survival, all that sort of stuff on indemnification. And a lot of times letters of intent will simply spell out that the definitive agreement will contain customary reps and warranties, covenants and indemnities to transactions like this. I think if I was a seller, I would say, let's just put some flesh on those bones and let's just find out what you guys are really looking for in terms of indemnity from me. Is there going to be an escrow holdback? How long? Are there going to be deductibles or baskets before I have to start paying claims? Are there going to be caps? I mean, I think that it's important to get that in the focus. Now, some buyers, are going to be kind of resistant to that, and they'll say, well, it all depends on kind of what comes out in due diligence. And you point out that, well, the letter of intent is not binding in many respects, and this is really one of them, but this is a pretty good guide for what we know right now. So you kind of, I think a seller has the better argument on that, and I would definitely strive for that. If there's going to be, if one of the transactions is going to be like what has been discussed here, where there's a rollover of equity, a continuity of some management, and the like, essentially a recapitalization along the lines that Wade and Dennis have described, then the mechanics of those kinds of transactions really ought to be spelled out well. It's important to the draftsman of the definitive agreement to see that stuff. It's really important to the tax advisors of both parties to have a hand in pretty much sketching out the framework of that kind of a transaction. I mean, there are a lot of really great tax and economic benefits from such a transaction. There's a lot of places you can stub your toe on them, too. And so rather than wait for the definitive agreement to sort of get to where you're fully understanding what the deal is, that's, I think, a good place to put into the letter of intent, the details of that. Finally, just I'm now on page or flag or slide 30, just to a couple of points here. Should your lawyer look at your letter of intent? I imagine the lawyers on the call have all had the experience of the client calling and bringing in the signed letter of intent, and you're looking at it and realizing that that your client may have given away the store. There may be some stuff that may even be binding in the thing. Absolutely, the letter of intent ought to be looked at before it's signed. Can a person do it themselves? Can a lawyer who's inexperienced do one? Well, obviously they can, but the chances of going wrong on one of these things is not that hard. There's a lot of risks. You sign a binding contract. It turns out that it's a binding agreement as opposed to just a letter of intent. You agree to a structure that's got real tax disadvantages and what have you. I'll just cite to you one article that's worth taking a look at when you have time to read something casually. It's When a Letter of Intent Goes Wrong, and it was put out in the ABA section of Business Law Today, and it's going to sound dated January, February 1996, but it's still a pretty good compendium of cases in which parties to non-binding letters of intent, for one reason or another, found out they were in a contract. And somebody was trying to ram it down their throat. So that's worth taking a look at and worth just sort of having in the back of your mind. That's it in kind of a 30,000-foot elevation look at letters of intent, but I think those are kind of the important points that I wanted to make. And so with that, Stephen, I'm going to turn it over to you.
Okay, thank you, Bob. This is going to be a very broad overview. The materials that provided are pretty extensive on tax. The key point here is that when you're on the sell side, obviously you want to keep as much money as you can from the sale and pay the government the least amount of money that's legally possible to pay. From a sell side, on slide 32, the first question you have to ask yourself is, what's being sold? Are we dealing with a corporation? Is it a C corp? Is it an S corp? Are we dealing with a partnership or a limited liability company? Under our federal code, limited liability companies default to being taxed as partnerships, and unless you make a special election. And a partnership and an S corp are not subject to double tax, meaning that the earnings and the income flow through to the owners or the equity holders of these entities, and a separate corporate level tax is not imposed. In contrast, if you have a C corporation, and there are C corporations out there in privately held businesses, for whatever reasons, either historic or they cannot elect to be an S corp, C corporations are subject to double taxation under our system. That's an important distinction, and that'll drive how these dispositions are set up, because on the sell side, when you're looking to sell a business or representing a seller, you want to make sure that the seller has, on the sale of the business or the equity in the business, one level of tax. And that level of tax, you want to apply a 15% long-term capital gains rate. In contrast, if you don't set it up properly and you're dealing with a C corporation and you negotiate to sell assets, thinking you're striking a great price, we'll just sell assets and liquidate the company, you're exposing the seller to double level of tax, a tax at the corporate level on the asset sale, and then a tax on the liquidation at the shareholder level. It's a disaster. It could be the difference between a 15% overall rate federally compared to a 44% rate. The second point on slide 32 is in these deals, as were mentioned earlier, the sellers sometimes want to keep skin in the game, or the buyers want them to have a continuing equity interest going forward. So if they're continuing to be employed with the company and providing services, they have a vested interest in making sure that the entity after the sale is successful. In those types of situations, you want to make sure that the seller, whether they're retaining equity or they're receiving equity in the acquirer, is receiving in a tax-free rollover or tax-free exchange where they're not reporting that as taxable consideration. There are mechanisms for doing that, such as where the acquirer is a partnership and you can receive partnership interest or LLC interest on a tax-free basis. There are also mechanisms where you can receive corporate stock on a tax-free basis. It's a little more difficult, but there are mechanisms in the corporate arena. I'm turning to slide 33. In some deals, you have either earnouts or promissory notes, where the buyer says, "I'll give you cash today, but you have to wait for the rest of your money. I either don't know how much your business is worth, and I want to do a wait and see. If you hit certain metrics, I'll pay you more money." Or they say, "You know, we've already established the price, and I can pay you some today, but I can fund payments later." In that respect, the most important thing from the seller is that they don't pay tax until they get their money, whether on the earnout or on the promissory notes. And there are specific rules which deal with that. In general, when you're selling stock of a private company, you can qualify for installment sale treatment. Where you're selling assets, the ability to have installment sale treatment will depend upon the types of assets you're selling. For example, if the installment obligation or the earnout is attributable to the sale or the value of goodwill, that earnout or installment obligation will be eligible for installment tax reporting. In contrast, if you have sale of inventory or accounts receivable and you have an installment obligation allocated to those items, that's not subject to installment sale reporting. The important point here is you can negotiate how you want to whack up the consideration, what's being sold for what. And that's an important thing to think about when you're representing on the sell side. The other thing also is, and this gets back to the point of double taxation, what is the animal that you're dealing with? What type of company do you have, a C-Corp, an S-Corp? If you have a C-Corp, invariably you're going to sell or want to sell on the sell side the stock of the C-Corp to have a single level of tax imposed at the stock, at the shareholder level. Often I see a seller comes after they've negotiated preliminary terms and they say, "I'm getting X amount of money, I'm selling assets, this is great, what are the tax consequences?" And you have to say to them, "You're going to have double level of tax. You should have sold stock." So they run back and they go to the buyer and say, "Wait a minute, we need to renegotiate this. We want to sell you stock." And the buyer, because the buyer is going to have a disadvantage in doing a stock deal versus an asset deal, will renegotiate the price and lower the price. So it's important to know what you're dealing with, at least as far as the type of entity you're selling, and figuring out how we're going to dispose or sell of the sell the company. The other aspect is just to keep in the back of your mind, when you're dealing with S-Corps, S-Corps in general are not subject to a double level of tax, except if they were C-Corps in the last 10 years. You have situations where you can have something called a built-in gains tax. So you need to ask the question. If you're on the sell side and you've made the election within the last 10 years and you were prior C-Corp, you need to be aware that you just can't simply say, "Oh, we're not subject to double level tax anymore, let's just negotiate to sell our assets," because there is this potential of a built-in gains tax. And the government has set up the rules that unless you can prove otherwise as far as what your built-in gain amount was at the time you elected S status, they're going to assume that everything is subject to a built-in gains tax. And so it's important to do some due diligence in determining the history of that particular S corporation. On the buy side, slide 34, what you want on the buy side, if you can get it, is you want to be able to have your purchase price allocated to the purchase of assets. Typically in these deals, companies have written off their assets in the past, so they have a very low tax basis. And if you can purchase assets, you can allocate your consideration that you're paying to the assets, and you can write them off. It used to be under, before some changes in our tax code, you couldn't write off goodwill. They changed that rule. Now you can write it off over 15 years straight line as a buyer. So that's deductions that you don't want to forgo if you can possibly set this transaction up as a asset sale. 2 points I want to mention on slide 34 is the practicality of doing an actual asset sale may not be available because you have non-assignable contracts. You have licenses or you might have transfer taxes, and it's just unwieldy. There are two mechanisms which are sometimes available where the IRS will let you pretend that you've purchased assets where you've really purchased stock, and one is something called a 338H10 election, and where you're dealing with the sale of the stock of a corporation, and the other is a 754 election where you're dealing with the sale of a interest in a partnership or a limited liability company. With the 754, it's where you're buying less than all of the interest. If you're buying all the interest, you don't need to worry about a 754. It would just be treated as an asset purchase on the buy side. Buyers will look for the availability of an H-10 election. And on the sell side, what you need to be aware of is what the differential is. If I don't make this election versus if I do make this election, am I paying more tax or less tax? And in some instances, sellers, to protect themselves, will ask to be grossed up or indemnified for any additional taxes. Just some points to keep in the back of your mind when you're thinking about buying or selling. On the buy side, you want to make sure that you're basically buying the business, you're not buying the tax problems of the target company, and there you need to just get the right amount of protections in the acquisition agreements where certain representations and warranties are made by the target company and its shareholders that we've complied with the tax law, we filed our returns, we paid our taxes. So if that ends up not being the case, the buyer needs the ability to go back to the selling shareholders and get indemnified for unknown tax liabilities. Let's just skip, in the interest of time, to slide 49. When you have an expectation that you want a specific tax result, whether it be on the buy side and the sell side, it's always good to put in the agreement what the party's intent is as to that, and also to provide that the parties won't act in a manner inconsistent with that intent. On slide 50, you have to bear in mind that, you know, once you get the check or you're cashing out, it's not over yet. There are post-closing matters that have to be thought about from tax perspective, such as filing final returns. The buyer is going to, in typical situations, ask for you as the seller to indemnify for tax exposures up through the closing date. Then you as the seller want to be able to control those final returns that are being filed. Because if you're on the hook, you want to be able to control it. If there are these types of elections with H-10s, which are joint elections that are made between buyer and seller, that has to be spelled out in the agreement. If you're on the buy side and you forget to put that in, and you close the deal and you realize, hey, I want to do an H-10 election, the seller can say, I don't want to do it, and then you're stuck with the result of not getting an asset purchase and the benefits of write-offs. The other things that you need to think about are who controls audits, and if there are refunds, who gets those refunds. But that is a very high-level overview of the various tax considerations in these types of transactions. There is an appendix where I lay out the difference between taxable and tax-free transactions, and tax-free transactions with corporate targets and where you have a corporate acquirer typically involve the use of at least 40% or more of the acquirer stock being used in those types of transactions. Now I'd like to turn it over to Bob, and we can answer any questions that participants may have.
Okay, Stephen. Well, we don't have any questions, so I'm not sure if folks are waiting to submit them now. I mean, we had the one on the multiplier, and that was it. So, and I'm not sure if anybody from Thompson's on the line either, but unless we have some questions here in the next couple minutes, I guess we'll sign off. I want to thank Wade, Dennis, Stephen, all of you for taking your time to make the presentations today. I certainly hope that they were helpful and interesting to our audience. As far as the audience, thanks to all of you who tuned in today. Really appreciate your time. And you have our contact information, so if questions occur to you after the program is at an end, don't hesitate to get a hold of one of us. I mean, we'd be happy to hear from you, you know, later on. Oh, here's one. Let's see. Okay, well, this is not so much a question. He has a question, but he's going to get in touch with us. So there you go. Okay. Anybody else? Otherwise, I guess we're signing off. Thank you for being present today.
Thanks, everyone.
Thank you.
Thanks. Okay.
Bye-bye.